Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Problematic Fave Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos, and this week we have a wonderful episode about a movie I never knew existed, to be honest with you. And our guest is the wonderful, wonderful actress, singer, comedian even, performer, drag race icon, Peppermint, and we talk about the whodunit movie, the 1976 whodunit movie, Murder by Death, and it is a journey, folks. I don't know if you've seen it, but I suggest if you want to follow along, pause, and then watch the movie. It's only like an hour and a half. Pause, watch the movie, and then come back. Because there's a lot in this movie, but it's so fun. It basically, we talk about this on the podcast, it's basically Clue before there was Clue. It was kind of the blueprint for Clue, I want to be honest with you. Anyways, Peppermint is lovely, and we are so honored to have her on our pod. So without further ado, here is Problematic Fave with the iconic Peppermint.
I don't feel good about this.
There's a number on the wall for all of us, Angel.
Neil Simon's Murder by Death. Meanwhile, a short, sinister man who looks exactly like Truman Capote is preparing a diabolical weekend for the greatest detectives in the world. Eileen Brennan, Truman Capote, James Coco, Peter Falk, Alec Guinness, Elsa Lanchester.
The murderer is...
David Niven, Peter Sellers, Maggie Smith, Nancy Walker, Estelle Winwood, and Myron? Who is the one who done it in the number one who done it? Neil Simon's new comedy, Murder by Death.
Should make an exciting weekend.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Problematic Fave Podcast. This is your host, Dino Ray Ramos, and we have a wonderful guest this week. An incredible guest. An actor, singer, activist, a rencontreur, change maker, a renaissance woman performer. She has released 6 albums and is one of the most iconic RuPaul's Drag Race alums. She has been seen in numerous TV series and films, including Pose, Fire Island, Harlem, and most recently she starred in a Transparent musical. She also has her own stand-up special, So Sigh, TFX, and she recently appeared in Michelle Buteau's Netflix comedy, Survival of the Fittest, and on top of all of that, she is ACLU's first ever artist ambassador for trans justice. Please welcome the iconic, the legendary, Peppermint!
Hey, Dino Ray!
Oh my gosh, the crowd is out of control today. You know, they're ringing sirens for you. They know that you're here on these streets.
Hey, honey, darling. They better know. They better ring the alarm. Ring the alarm.
ring the alarm like they did during you weren't here, but the hurricane here.
Sounding sirens.
When it was raining hardcore, and I was all whatever, you know, it's like I'm from Texas, so I'm used to thunderstorms and whatever. But then Mother Nature had other plans that day and decided to throw in an earthquake, and it lasted a pretty minute. It lasted a while.
I was just like, oh wow.
It's
not personal, darling. It's not personal. It's our fault.
It is our fault.
I know.
Given this world,
it's really tough. I mean, generally, in the early aughts, whenever there was a natural disaster or something, we were able to use social media as an alert system, or like people saying that they're safe on Facebook, things like that. People sending out their, you know, thoughts and prayers on, you know, to everybody impacted. But lately, it's really difficult to do that because, like, when there's simultaneous, disasters happening, like earthquakes and first-time hurricanes.
Fires in Maui.
And there, and then fires in Maui. And then there was there's other wildfires still happening. Then we had like 7 tropical storms the same day on the East Coast. What is going on?
The girls were coming out.
Honey.
The girls were coming out.
She's Mother, like, oh, you remember Mother that Nation plastic bottle? You remember that plastic bottle?
Mother has really arrived.
She's like, really arrived, darling. Front door and back door. Okay. Gang banged.
Peppermint, we were talking earlier. That was a delayed reaction. Gang banged. Mother Nature is just not playing. She's mm-mm. just like, oh, I'm going to give you all of the darling. Elements. Like storm. So wait, Peppermint, you know, how are you? Like, where's your head at today? What's the temperature on you? I know you've been out, we were just talking about you on these striking streets, you know, and you know, you're a performer and like, oh, where's your head at right now in life and in career? Are you okay? Are you taking care of yourself mostly?
How dare you? I'm great. I feel great. I feel grateful and very blessed and, you know, fortunate, because looking back 10, even 20 years when I was still in the entertainment industry, I never knew that I'd be able to do any of the things that I'd be doing today. I knew that I had the ability to do a lot of the things, but I didn't know that I'd have the opportunities to do those things and that and how it would be received, if anybody would be enthusiastic about those things. And just listening to your intro, thank you so much, a lovely intro.
Of course.
You know, it struck me how many of the things I've had the chance to do lately. And I say lately because, you know, when I moved to New York, I was moved here for college, and I was going to acting school during the day, and then I was working as a drag performer at night. And given that, like, you know, there wasn't a lot of confidence, not that they didn't think I was a good actor. I don't really know what they thought. But they basically were saying, you know, there's no work for someone like you in the industry. Mm. And they weren't lying. And so obviously I found the world of drag, which has been great to me. And I love it. And I've done so many things. I've traveled the world and had a lot of opportunities and really came into my own doing the art of drag. But I had so many other loves, like singing and dancing and acting, obviously, and just all these different things. And so I just never knew where that would fit. And it was really, I tried it when I, you know, first graduated college for acting. I went out into the world and was auditioning and things like that and just didn't get the warmest reception. I was only always cast as like a prostitute, streetwalker victim. So there was plenty of work for me on Law and Order. Which I did a few times.
The procedurals.
Yes,
the
procedurals, yeah, all those. Of them all. but I remember thinking back when I was younger, I heard a quote from John Amos, who was the father on Good Times. I was listening to him do a lecture to some acting students, and I don't remember what it was, but he said, one of the acting students claimed, oh, I'm an actor, I'm a professional actor. And he corrected that student and said, well, since you're still a student and, you know, yada, yada, you're only a professional if you're earning a living doing that thing, which is, that's basic and obvious, but it really rung true. I was like 10 years old when I heard him say that. So that was like mind blowing to me. But I remember that my whole life. And so when I was after graduating school and trying to audition and do these different things and not really getting many things, I went into the world of drag and I worked as was doing entertainment through drag and different types. I was getting acting jobs as a drag entertainer. I worked at a Lips restaurant, which is a legendary drag restaurant where the girls do shows and are also your servers. I had my own shows in the bars and clubs, and I was doing that. I was working 7 nights a week and making all of my bills, barely, but I was making them in New York. As a performer. And so I was like, I am a professional entertainer. And I was like 20. And so like, I felt like I made it then, and that never turned off. So like, now everything I do just feels like the icing on the cake. I love it. And I, of course, have goals and things I want to attempt and do. But I feel like I've made my mark.
Oh my God, no. It's like, I think you are so right. And I love that kind of attitude. I've been trying to be that way lately, you know, just like kind of like all instead of like dwelling on what I don't have. It's like, oh, bitch, look at where you're at. You know, it's like, oh, sometimes we forget that, you know, some people would love to be in your shoes. Like, it could take a minute, you know, like Heidi Klum said on Project One Runway, one day you're in and the next day you're out.
Let's start the show. I just had to finish that quote because that's always what she said.
Let's start the show. You know, I've been rewatching Project Runway seasons because they're older all seasons. On Peacock. They're
oh my God, it's a motherfucking walk-off, darling. Remember that one?
Zulema? The Zulema episode. And then they were all, she just wanted attention. They were
like, I live. It was, I felt like my drag life that crossed into the thing. Wait, tell me.
She was like, I remember there was that one episode where she was like, it was a team challenge and everyone hates a team challenge. Mm-hmm. And her partner was crying and she was all, I don't care if you cry, but you got to cry and cut when she was cutting fabric.
Some of the greatest quotes.
I loved it. I love any reality competition series like a Drag Race, like a Project Runway that requires a skill or trade and there's an end product at the end. Top Chef.
Oh,
anything
yeah.
that requires like an actual talent. Sorry.
Now, do you watch the short-term but, ones yeah. like Nailed It? Like where it's just like yes, in one episode Nailed and they it. Bake it. Or yeah. Great, but it's great as baking show.
Yeah. Yeah, the one-offs mm-hmm. are great. I like me a bake-off. Mm-hmm. I love me Nicole Byer. Okay, so you picked a very interesting movie. Before we get into it, you know, the movie is called Murder by Death, directed by Robert Moore, released by Columbia Pictures on June 23rd, 1976, and written by Neil Simon. Let's kind of discuss where the world was at this time. Now, April 1976, Apple was formed by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. Did not know that. Minimum wage in 1976 was $2.50 an hour.
Jeez, Lord.
Jimmy Carter was elected the 39th president by defeating incumbent President Gerald Ford. Nadia Comaneci won 3 gold medals at the Montreal Olympics with 7 perfect scores. Songs on the radio included Silly Love Songs by Wings, Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Elton John and Kiki D, Love Hangover by Diana Ross, She's Gone by Hall & Oates, and Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. On TV, Laverne and Shirley, What's Happening, Charlie's Angels, which originally starred Kate Jackson, Farrah Fawcett, the original cast in leading roles, all premiered in 1976, and Gone with the Wind had its first television broadcast on NBC. And that same year, Carol Burnett aired the episode Went with the Wind, a movie parody on Gone with the Wind, which is now an iconic show. Yeah. Iconic, the curtain dress.
With the curtain dress. Yeah, curtain dress.
Yes. And then 1976 was also the year Rocky was released. So, all that said, that's a lot. A lot happened in 1976, as well as this wonderful movie, Murder by Death. So, Peppermint, we talked about it briefly, but I really want to get into that later. But what is your connection to this movie? This was a very interesting movie because I don't think a lot of people know about this movie.
Yeah, you know, I do think it's something from my childhood, and I was obsessed. You know, I think one of the things that I was really obsessed about were the artwork on the covers of the rental store video VHS cassette tapes when you would go through and each of these cassette tapes kind of would tell the story like in a more creative way than they do now. Now it's like the poster, I guess it tells a story. I don't want to diminish the graphic artists who work on a lot of.
I will. No.
But back then, I think it was much more crucial because I think what people experience about movies first these days is video content. They're more likely to see a clip of something than they are to actually see the poster or the little thumbnail that you would click on when you're like renting it online or watching it. Generally. that's my opinion. But in the video store, a lot of times you would just go and be like, let's rent a movie, not knowing what you're going to get or what's going to be available or any of that. Yeah, yeah. And then you just have to choose from what looks like it's good. And you like actually have to read. And I was obsessed with those video covers, the covers. And I was obsessed with the ones that had like, this is so random, that had like dark houses or bricks on the cover, or like shady people peeking out of the windows and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
And so that led me to a lot of whodunit
murder mystery films,
but always the comic ones. So Clue, Murder by Death, Murder on the Orient Express, just all these different things. It led me to, and so that's how I found it. My mom, I think, had seen it, and I just thought it was hilarious. I had a few like tinges of like, ooh, there was a few cringe moments. Even then, yeah. I remember, but the fact that it was this absurdist sort of comedy, and I fell in love with Clue first, and then saw this movie and was astounded and floored. And watching it again recently to prepare for this, I remembered this was definitely a blueprint for Clue. You know,
yes.
So we can talk more about that. But so that's why I love.
No, yeah, you're right. That's so. But I love how you said about how we would go to a Blockbuster, or in Texas it was Hollywood Video, or the video store. Every Friday night, you know, you would solely judge. Well, of course, you would have like kind of the first run popular movies. But then other than that, video cassette tape covers did a lot of heavy lifting. It was just like, oh, hey, watch us. I remember one particular movie. I forgot the name of it, actually, but I just clearly remember the cover, and it was a horror, and it was about cannibalism. It had these people on. It frightened me, but I was also like, oh,
what?
Ooh, that's kind
what
of
what was
like,
happening in it. I'm sure I've seen it.
Okay. I want to say, not is it Randy Quaid? Someone was in it, like very popular. It was about these parents who were cannibals, but it was like a horror comedy. It was like in the 80s.
Doing in it? Like, obviously, they were eating people,
No, they were like parents who were normal, and they were feeding their kids human, I think. That was the story.
And just like cooking it into the food and things like that?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Something. It was like some sort of cult or something like that. Very B-movie. Oh. It was very B-movie. You know what? It's going to bother me. I want to say... but anyways. So I really appreciate... DVD art and VHS art. There is like, before we get into it, there is this artist on Instagram who I found who creates VHS cover tapes from first run movies. And
from current ones.
The VHS. Current. I'm going to show you them. I have them right in front of me right here.
Oh my gosh. Lies.
Lies and not. So Devon's tape. So he created Everything Everywhere All at Once. And it actually is the movie. I have a VCR too. He also
have you watched anything?
Yes.
I need to get me a VCR. God.
Look.
Wow.
Get Out.
He created that.
Isn't that? Yeah. And then it's just, I think I bought some as gifts, and they're always like limited edition.
They obviously are. Really, oh my gosh. So does he just does the artwork and then puts the film on tape?
Yeah. And then like, I think he gets around kind of copyright saying that this is art or it's parody or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously not commercially sold.
Yeah. 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 So I think there's probably some art.
It's a friend making a copy of their personal tape for you, which we're allowed to do.
Yeah. Like a mixtape. Like mixtape.
I love it. You have to let me know who that is, because
hopefully he's still around. Because this was during the pandemic, like pandemic. Like, and I was just like, when we were just buying shit online over and over again, that was me. But I'm glad
the AMPTP went to his house. Uh oh. Paid him a visit.
They're like, oh, sir.
Hello.
Sir, come, we know come, what come, you're come, doing come. In there. So Murder by Death. So the Murder by Death stars, the cast is out of control.
It's wild.
Eileen Brennan. Yeah. Truman Capote. James Coco, Peter Falk, Alec Guinness, Obi-Wan Kenobi, for crying out loud, Elsa Lancaster, David Niven, Peter Sellers, Maggie Smith, the Dame Maggie Smith, Nancy Walker, and Estelle Winwood. The summary via Rotten Tomatoes. This is via Rotten Tomatoes. It's a very interesting summary. Five diverse, infamous private eyes, including Sam Diamond, Peter Falk, Sydney Wang, Peter Sellers, and Jessica Marbles, Elsa Lancaster, are invited to the mysterious Lionel Twain's castle for a dinner party. There, they are told that Twain's plans are an unsolvable murder in the house at midnight, and he will pay $1 million to the one who determines the killer. But when Twain's blind butler, Benson Mum, oh my god, Alec Guinness dies long before the deadline, the stakes go up for Trap Sleuths. And for people who haven't watched this, I this was my first time watching this. I kind of just set it up. Each character, if I'm not mistaken, is based like a parody on an existing sleuth, right?
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Either actual like storybook characters or film
characters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like
detectives.
I think it's Charlie Chan, definitely supposed to be Sydney Wang. That's a major one. Hold on, let me see. And who else is there? Oh yeah, and then Miss Marple, who I'm not familiar with, that's supposed to be Jessica Marbles, and then Hercule Poirot, who is obviously, you know, the most famous one, and that's supposed to be the actor. I forgot his name. Anyways, we'll get to that. But anyways, and then what I want to start off with right off the bat, I love it. I love this mess. Right off the bat, because it's not streaming anyway. You could stream it. You could rent it. It's not like for free anywhere, but you could rent it on Amazon. The screen you rent it on has Peter Sellers, full on yellow face.
I say, you don't happen to have seen a little white Wang?
A white Wang?
Good heavens, Sydney Wang. What are you doing in this godforsaken spot?
No doubt, same as you. Looking for a bridge that lead to Home of Horse.
Like, that's the that's the picture on the screen that says, hey, rent this movie so you could watch this.
Terrible.
And already I was on ready.
Screams problematic.
And I was just like, you know, when I smoked a joint, I was ready. I was ready for
that's
it.
That's actually good. Weed movie.
It is. But you were saying, I love the opening credit sequence.
With the paper dolls and the drawings. I think it's just brilliant. It's such great artwork. It tells the story a bit. It's really engaging, and it kind of really brings you into the story. And that's so much more interesting than just showing like the landscape and just titles going across the thing. It introduces each of the characters, and it's almost like a bit of a theatrical overture for those people who are like Broadway aficionados or people who go to see professional live theater. The classic style of plays will have an overture where they'll play a bit of each of the songs that are going to be featured in the play. And then you have a chance to kind of go kind of through the story before the curtain even opens. And so that's kind of what this feels like. And it's clear that they're telling us, they're like, sit down and let us tell you a story, which I think is really an engaging and endearing way to get people, sort of introduce who the characters are before they ever even come onto the screen.
Yes. And I think it's the same artist who did like the cover art. I'm guessing it's the same artist that
it
did
must
the cover
be.
Art for the
it
VHS and all. Yeah. And it's Charles Adams, who is the creator of the Adams Family. And it kind of goes with your love for like these dark. Yes, yes. And I love that. I'm loving it. But I think what was so interesting about this movie is just like all it was. I really want to talk about like what you said before. This was Clue before it was Clue. Absolutely. Right? This was basically Clue. It was. But in this very absurdist, very like swing for the fences, problematic ways. And that's like all it was very, very interesting. And what is it about Miss? Like, I think visually, I think it is very appealing. But is there something about mysteries and whodunits that you.
Oh, just one second. I just have to. Something's at my door. One second.
So sorry. Was that your DoorDash?
Yes.
Really? You
delivered some crack. No. It wasn't DoorDash.
What?
It wasn't DoorDash.
You said delivered crack. No.
Hey, these days were...
Would you buy Kirkland brand weed? Like, if Costco started selling weed... Would you like
Yes, because I actually don't smoke weed. So for the things I don't do, I'll buy the cheapest things for my friends. I don't drink coffee. So you better believe I've got Folgers crystals right up in my house. And if you want coffee, you take one spoon or two and get the hot water and you stir it in. And here's your coffee. Here's your cup of coffee. I ain't brew no coffee. Pot.
But that's nice of you to... But you know what? I see that as you're mindful of your guests.
Yeah,
that's
I keep, I don't drink and I have booze in my house. I keep it. It's getting a little dusty sometimes, but I have booze and I always keep a cold six pack in the fridge. I don't drink. It's been there for like 2 years. Does it go bad? I don't know.
Have you thought of like starting your own lifestyle brand?
No, absolutely not.
Because you are giving lifestyle. Like, I always keep a six-pack in the fridge.
I keep one just in case. And every once in a while, you have to crack something open for your friend. So you'll have something to serve your guests. Because I don't...
But also, I think that's like a indication of good home training. You know? I think, like, I'm like, you know, I think also... You know, Filipinos are very hospitable, so I'm always the same way. It's like, I always have to have extra food just in case.
Yeah, just in case somebody's going to come over, so you don't have to worry, and then they'll have something, you know. But then sometimes your good friends are like, Folgers, I need a cold brew.
A latte.
Bitch, you make it with cold water. It goes with cold water. You put the sprinkles in, and it turns to cold water.
Come on, Folgers, cold brew. I'm loving... Folgers, we love you.
We love you.
The best part of waking up is you. The best part, you said it yourself, the best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup. So what is it about mysteries and whodunits that kind of, because you mentioned before, it's like that visual aspect of it, yes, but like, what is it about like these narratives that appeal to you?
You know, I probably would have to like sit down and really, really, really break it down. But on first thought, I think I'm really drawn to ensemble pieces that like have a team of people that kind of, it doesn't work without everyone in the story working together. Like the actual, what they have to do in the show. And it's for the most part, kind of equal and even. And I think maybe in ensemble pieces, and I'm just analyzing here, I have no idea. I think as a queer woman and as a queer person growing up, equal representation was probably deep in my mind, or I was drawn to those things. And in ensemble pieces, women are elevated to a higher level of importance and significance in the story than they would be in any other situation.
The greatest living criminologist in the world is sitting at this table. No, don't look at each other. Look at me. I'm the greatest. I'm number one.
To me, you look like number two. Know what I mean?
What does he mean, Miss Skeffington? I'll tell you later. It's disgusting.
As we see in Murder by Death, not to spoil it, often in many of the scenes, it's the partners, because each of the detectives are invited to this weekend, to spend a weekend at this murder mystery house, and they all bring a guest. They all have like a partner, sometimes a spouse, a different person. And so for the women who are the partners, They are really the brains of the operation in many of those in many of those cases. You can see that very clearly. And they're often the brave ones, not to spoil it, but there's a couple scenes where there's some danger.
Oh, we could spoil
present.
It.
The women are the ones walking to get the gas when the car breaks down. The women are the ones taking the bomb and defusing it and blowing it up in their face to save the men. The women are the one taking the poisonous scorpion bite. They're obviously being abused in that situation. I don't think it's like desirable, but it shows like this sort of braveness that, or this sort of strength and maybe resilience that these women are inadvertently being, you know, elevated to. And so that's probably one aspect of it. Really do like, I think that's probably the biggest aspect of it. You know, strength in the women characters emerges in these murder mysteries a little bit more than it does in other types of films.
No, I kind of agree with you. I've never realized that before, because I think that's why maybe it's just queer people. I don't know. There's this thing about seeing an ensemble, and like, as cheesy as it may sound, as you said, this, they're working together for a common cause, and feels like everyone is on this
equal
level playing field, no matter
that.
What they are. Yeah.
And
it's just like, oh, someone's dead. And then they're like, oh, we are all in the same boat because someone's dead.
Yeah.
And like, no one is. Yeah.
If it's a mystery, then it allows, and it sort of forces the writers to present situations where everything isn't what it seems. And so everybody's identity is in question. And then you get people with the double leading double lives and double identities. And this person is really gay, or this person's really a woman, or this person's. And I don't know if you saw Soap Dish, which is another really popular, problematic,
yes.
Where someone's really a woman who had been a trans.
Yes. we had Cristela Alonso, comedian, come on to discuss.
Yeah, we both
Soap Dish on last season.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Last season she came on and we talked about Soap Dish, which I love. It's such, like you said, it's such
classic.
A great ensemble. Yeah. But that Montana Moorhead situation.
Terrible. Terrible. I wanted to write into the manager as a young kid watching that movie. On HBO.
You were like, let me speak to a manager.
Darling.
HBO manager, where are you?
Hello. But everybody, but she wasn't the only character who had like a hidden secret. They all had hidden secrets, right? In Soap Dish, you know. And so, except for Whoopi's
character. Here
too. Yeah, and in this one too. Yeah. So that's what I love about this.
I love that. It's like, we're discovering things about problematic movies. It's like, I think mysteries, especially for queer people, I think we love a reveal, period.
A reveal.
On the Drag Race stage. A reveal in any sort of way. A reveal, even when someone brings fajitas to your table at Chili's, that's a reveal.
And they pull the little...
Oh my God, steam.
Steam, sizzle. Darling. Those tortillas are hot, darling. It's
no,
sizzling.
But I think we're on to something. No, I think it's true, though. It's like, I think maybe especially when we were closeted, or when we were, you know, we weren't fully developed in our identity yet, we see a reveal as aspirational, right? It's like,
agreed.
Oh, hey.
Yeah.
It's
and
like,
it's empowering
I'm here.
Us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I love, that's why I still love me Scream. I know horror is forever a like queer genre, but Scream, I will watch Scream until I die, the day I die. Give me Scream 100, I will continue to watch.
Me too. I was heartbroken on 5 or whatever the last, not the most recent, but the last one when we
the
lost
one before
Huey.
That.
Yeah, that was, because I feel like Huey was like, he was obviously the heart of the show. And of the movie, but yeah, I agree. I love Scream. I love all these murder mysteries, and Scream is like the modern day murder mystery comedy that we have. You know, I think of it. It's a dark comedy.
Yeah, but okay. So I do want to just kind of the biggest problem in this is, of course, Peter Sellers playing Sidney Wang, however you know, depending on how you pronounce it. So we already know what's happening, but I did not realize that this was in 1976. It's not, 1976 was not that long ago. Well, first off, you know, I was wondering, as soon as I saw that, I was wondering how the real Asian who was playing opposite of Peter Sellers that time during the shoot, his name is Richard Narita, mm-hmm. how he was feeling.
Here's the bridge, Pop. Doesn't look safe to me.
One way to find out, drive across.
Aren't you going to come with me?
Weight of two men may be too much for bridge.
Then why do I get to drive the car?
Because I smart enough to get out first.
I was just like,
I cannot have felt good about it. But yeah, I mean, these like, are people who there's something this movie, in addition to being aside from the movie being so like in my mind now, I don't know if it was groundbreaking, but certainly was able to like play on a lot of the probably able to set some trends, like I said, with Clue, which follows the format, the formula, and also even some of the cinematic styles with like Clue and in Murder by Death does a lot of these like really interesting close-ups on the killer's hands and the things that they're doing. Mm. The close-up on the window, the scary window, it's like a stained glass window with the lightning, and it's like that's like its own shot. It's not just like you see people in the room and the lights flash and oh, there must be lightning out in the window. They like show the window like it had solo like close-up moment. the car in this car in this foggy woods and the woman having to do the work that happens in Clue. Anyway, there's a lot of things that are really similar to Clue in this movie. But the one thing that's really interesting is it harkens back to like film noir, like Private Dick movies of the 1930s.
Yes,
and that's when Yellowface was like running rampant, right?
All the rage. It was all the rage.
I think it would have been impossible to do a movie that like felt like a whodunit of yesteryear from the 1930s, but mm-hmm. not address the notion of Yellowface. Now, how you address it is differently. Today, we would talk about it and say, we're not going to do that. And talk about why it was problematic back then. But then they just did it.
Again. Yeah, and I think, again, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about earlier with Revenge of the Nerds, the context culture of it all. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's wrong, but they didn't know any better, but it doesn't mean it's right, right? It's just like, that's how they were. And that's what was normal to them. And we see that today. And I see Richard Narita, and I wanted to just say his name over and over again, because I'm guessing Peter Sellers took over that. And it's just like, and Richard Narita is still around, guys. He's still alive. Yeah. He's still acting. Yeah. But I was just like, oh God, it must have, to be Richard there and like, to kind of like see, you know, this guy portray this ambiguous, it was just like, I was like very empathetic to him. But also at the same time, I was just like, oh, maybe it was just so ignorant that it was funny. You know, it's just like, oh, I just have to laugh because it's weird, but it's like, oh, we see blackface, we see yellowface, you know, what do we call it? Like, queer face. I don't know, queer face.
Yeah.
Is that a thing, queer face?
Gay face.
Is that how we say it? Gay face. Serving gay face. Well,
there is trans face, you know. And
trans, I mean, we've seen it in, people have won Oscars for it, you know? It's like, oh, well, why aren't we surprised? And it's like, we don't have to do anything, but I try to watch this to kind of like, I'm just like, okay, it's wrong, but this is just what it was. It doesn't mean it's right, you know?
Yeah, and I do think it was also very tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. Like, they knew what they were doing. It's not like they didn't know. They clearly knew it was wrong. The fact that they cast, you know, someone who is of Asian descent and someone who's not, next playing family members was obvious. And it's not lost on me that the person who's portrayed or sort of within the context of the story sort of shown to be the inauthentic person is Richard Narita, who is is Japanese in the film as well, and is like the father, the Chinese father who's in yellow face, Peter Sellers playing a Chinese man, is basically looking down on his adopted child and basically always jabbing at him as though he's not good enough. He's not, you know, as if he's not good enough, partially probably because he's adopted. But I also think it's like because he's Japanese, and it's really interesting.
Exactly.
The white guy playing the Chinese guy coming down on the guy, on the Japanese son, because he's not enough, is just very rich. And he's also really Americanized. You realize that Richard Narita's character doesn't, he's from a USC sweater. Yeah. And he's like American. You know what I mean? Like he's this Americanized.
He's like super duper Asian American.
Yeah.
It's like a whole level of like self-hating Asian.
Yeah, very much.
It's like, it is like, and also it's like, it does like these weird things with the trope of like, oh, you have to bring honor to our family, which is another Asian kind of trope thing. But it's so interesting you say that. It's like, and going back to how the women, like usually the, their plus ones had more sense than the actual detective, right? And in this case, it was the real Asian who had more sense than his father, and he was just like, oh, but the father refuses to listen to him.
Refuse.
Like everyone else. I don't know about like the French guy Perrault James Cromwell, who played a French chauffeur.
Yeah. None of those actors are French.
You bought buns and you didn't tell me. Where are they? Where are the buns?
Oh no, monsieur, the buns in my body.
You should not speak with an accent when you know I'm so hungry.
And it was a very bad, we should mention, it was a problematic French presentation as well. I forgot how sexy
gross.
James Cromwell was. I was like, oh my God, not him in this sheer outfit.
That sheerness was giving Folsom Street Fair.
Darling.
It was giving Folsom Street Fair.
And it was homoerotic
category
across the board. The homoeroticism was like homoeroticism.
Yeah. Come on, homoeroticism.
Yeah.
No, but okay, first off, James Cromwell, who is also known as the guy from Babe and the father who didn't give a fuck about anyone in Succession. He was in Succession too. He was a tasty treat. But still now I think he's a handsome man. I also want to give a shout out to Eileen Brennan, who was Miss Peacock in Clue.
Absolutely.
You know, she plays.
Yeah, and she.
And that was very interesting there.
And she plays like this sort of stereotypical. The lines of like the power dynamic were all over the place with her character and Peter Faulkner's character, who later on played Columbo just a few years later.
And
Yeah.
It looked like the same character to me.
It's Columbo. He's Columbo in this movie. But the fact that this woman was like his secretary, but also his assistant, but also his mistress. Like, that's how he literally introduced her to the room of strangers. That she works for me and she's my mistress. Was just showing like the imbalance in power dynamic and the like. There's clearly was no HR department at his office.
Now, if one of you gentlemen would be so kind as to give my lady friend here a glass of cheap white wine, I'm going down the hall to find a can.
Yeah, but the fact that I love her playing, and a lot of times I think post this, and I don't know that much about Eileen Brennan's work, but I'm a big fan of her because of Clue and Private Benjamin. Which she plays
Private Benjamin.
Women who are not necessarily, they're not presented in their sexual power. And this woman, although she's like the peon of Peter Faulkner's character, Sam Diamond, she is kind of like the smoky, almost femme fatale in the movie. Mm. She's like the, you know, the blonde bombshell of the movie. And I found that really interesting, and I really enjoyed her in that sort of presentation. I'm sure she has lots more. I don't want to be ageist here. I'm sure she has lots of stuff where she's like this young blonde earlier in her career, and then obviously she was probably playing, you know, more mature characters. Mrs. Peacock, she was playing way older than she actually was back in the 80s. Like Mrs. Peacock is like some 80-year-old lady, but Eileen Brennan clearly was not 80 at the time. And so,
yeah,
I found that interesting.
No, I think I love her. You know, I love that character. You know, I also loved Maggie Smith. I think they and I forgot the other actor's name. The couple
that okay, was supposed Maggie to kind of represent. Husband?
Yeah, Nick and Nora. They represented. I guess they're a spy team from the Thin Man.
David like, Niven. Kind of this...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they were like this, and like I love me. I will watch anything with Maggie Smith, just because you know we have to. But
I mean,
but going back, I want to go back to yeah, of course. Going back to the yellow face of it all. Mm-hmm. Hold on, I accidentally put that up. Yeah. Going back to the yellow face of it all, mm-hmm. I think so. The character of Sidney Wang was based on Charlie Chan, which was a character, a detective created by a man from Ohio. This white man, his name is Earl Derbiggers, I guess. Mm-hmm. He was a novelist. He created this Chinese detective named Charlie Chan, and the character has been played by multiple people. There have been ten of the 10 actors to play Charlie Chan. 3 of them were Asian. Four of them were Asian. Only one was Chinese, and the Chinese person to voice the character on an animated series. This actually tracks for Hollywood today, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's par for the course. They weren't having any of the minorities there, but they want to have our stories all over there.
Listen, but it's like also this is like also who gets to tell our stories, right? It's like all I always also think about that is who is telling our stories, and I mean there's like this very interesting conversation right now. I mean you're in the Broadway scene. You're familiar with Here Lies Love right now, right? Which is
I don't know
if you've seen it yet.
I have.
It's a very interesting show, but the Filipino it's a divided kind of conversation about that, just because of what Here Lies Love. Who they're portraying, mm-hmm. which is the Marcos regime, which was a lot of people didn't like that guy, woman.
I mean,
who's still alive.
The whole family. Yeah.
And one of them's in power right now.
Mm-hmm. I do want to say that the thing that is about Here Lies Love that is interesting and you know a very low bar to set, but that when we're in the context of Yellowface. All of the actors are of Filipino descent.
Filipino descent, which is, yeah.
And even people behind the scenes.
It's great. Yeah, and I'm loving that, but it's just like, it pains me to see, when your own community is just mm-hmm. like all, especially with, I'm always talking about this, especially with the Asian community, just mm-hmm. about like, we're not there yet. I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, we're together, but we're not there yet. I don't know if you get what I'm saying. It's just like, I'm not feeling a sense of community that we should be having.
Well, I think it's definitely possible. You know, I'm obviously not Asian, but I do.
Yeah.
I hear you. I think there's a lot of, when it comes to capitalist ventures like television, film, and Broadway, and representation, which is something we're all saying we want. How that representation plays out on camera, on film, on stage, I think looks different to different people, even people within the same community. And some people have a sort of, when it comes to just activism and art as activism, I think some people have a, let's blow up the whole system and clean it, bleach it, and then start from scratch with the right way. And some people are like, no, let's take baby steps and work within the system. And those are different approaches, hopefully to the same finish line or destination. And so I agree. I certainly don't think that we're there yet at all.
Yeah, I think even within the queer community, I'm not saying like, it's not perfect. I mean, of course it's not perfect. Sure. You know, like, there's a lot of infighting, but I feel like, no matter what, I feel like all communities show up for each other. I hope. You know, it's like, I hope everyone shows up for each other. But I get it. It's just like, I think of like something like this and how I know I joke and say, well, the fact that this Chinese character created by a white man hasn't been played by an actual Asian character, only was portrayed by an actual Asian actor 4 times out of the 10. And I joke and I say, oh, it's probably what happened today. It's kind of sad. It's just like, oh, there is no progress. It is sad. And it's just like, yeah.
It's the same people in charge in Hollywood. It's the same gatekeepers. It's the same people running the show. And it's only a few years ago that we were able to hear stories like Time's Up and hear and Me Too movements. Taking hold and making a little larger mark. All the things that were many of the strides that we're seeing in recent years in Hollywood are recent. You know, they're not like something that's been implemented 10, 20, 30 years ago. These are things that they may have been in the works or maybe had an idea many years ago, but things that started really, I think most of the changes happened post 2020, like during 2020 and then like in the past few years, literally. And so, Hollywood is racist, it's sexist, it's homophobic, it's misogynist, and that's just the story. Yeah. And it's being written by friends of people who are racist, sexist, misogynist, homophobic, ableist, and they cast these people, not saying that the actors are, but they cast people who are very, very closer to who they are, and trusting that they can tell someone else's story, even though they have no experience doing that. So like that, we're not, if it's a movie about, I'm sure the top grossing movie about a disabled person was played by someone who wasn't disabled. I'm sure the top grossing movie about, people of color were played and written by people who are not people of color. All these things, like it's always, there's always one culprit.
It's always, I think it's just like, I don't know if you've read Burn It Down by Maureen Ryan, that book about like burning it down. She was a guest on the podcast. She's a wonderful journalist on Vanity Fair. I don't know. It's just so interesting. And like, I don't see equity happening. Let's be honest. Because there will always be a culprit, as you said. What I always feel like what we can do is kind of like, I've been reading a lot and like about community organizing and all that stuff. It's like inoculate ourselves against, or try to protect ourselves. Because what can we control? We can't control this like system, because this system, the boat is already, it's going to take a while to turn around, because it's like turning around the Titanic. We can't. It's like, I always say, I'm trying to look out for myself, my community, and protect ourselves, but also it's like we're getting tired. I think watching this, I'm like, we've made a lot of strides, definitely. Don't get me wrong. But it's just like, but we see the same kind of things happening, but in different ways, It's kind of like, we're gonna put this black queer female director on top of this huge tentpole movie, but who's really directing it? Who's really like are you just using them as the face? It's like, that's where I'm just like, as a journalist, I'm supposed to be skeptical. It's kind of like what Maureen Ryan calls inclusivity cosplay. It's just like, it's kind of using the face.
I think that's the piece of this when you mention cosplay, it really does make me think back to the film and Mr. Wang's the character of Mr. Wang. I think that the creators of the film, I would imagine, I'd be surprised if they were actually looking for someone who could realistically portray a convincing Chinese person. I think they were just like, let's just get somebody who's a popular actor, who was a big blockbuster name back then, who's white, obviously.
That's true.
And just say, hey, here's some eye makeup, and here's some a mustache and a hat and some teeth, and put that on and do this really speak only in sort of like fortune cookie sort of dialogue, broken English, which is like you're reading it off. Everything is like some kind of like you're reading a fortune cookie.
Questions like athlete's foot. After a while. Very irritating.
All of his sentences were like, like some lesson, like speaking in similes, like the world is like a thing. He couldn't just say whatever he was trying to say. Anyway, that was not like, I don't even think that was like the best acting job. I don't even think Peter Sellers was like, this is convincing. I think if anything, the more absurd, because it was absurdist, the more like wild and sort of like crude and like, you know, offensive it could be.
Cartoonish.
And like cartoonish and, you know, caricaturish and not even, clearly not sensitive to the nuances, to any nuances, when it comes to racially and culturally, I think the better for them in their minds. That's my thought. I don't know what conversations they had, but that's what I think. You know,
that's a good point though. It's just like, oh, if he would actually be acting like a Chinese person, like what he thought a Chinese person would be,
it would not have been that.
That might be actually worse.
It may have been worse than
the caricature. Yeah.
It's
kind of like, we know Peter Sellers was big and he wanted to get the check. I think that's kind of the bottom line.
He wanted to get the check, and he probably saw nothing wrong with it. I mean, I did a workshop not that long ago of a play, and we, you know, there was some racial dynamics in the, and themes and some different things. And there was some violence in the story, and you know, the room was mixed sort of demographics, people of color, some white people, different ages and all the different identities and groups. And the one moment came where there was supposed to be a violent act perpetrated on a woman of color and a trans woman of color. And it's obviously was meant to be sort of like a moving moment. It took one of the white actors to say, and there was no black face or trans face in this project. They hired, you know, people who were actually the identity that they were portraying. But it took a woman of color, a person of color, excuse me, I'm sorry, a white person, to speak up and say, I'm not gonna be a part of this where you're like harming black bodies on stage for no reason. And it wasn't necessary for telling the story. It was just like, we need a victim. Oh, it might as well be the black person. That's how it came off. And then we had a chance to stop, and the directors and everybody said, we're gonna make this right, and they changed it. So I think that if Peter Sellers had, I would like to hope that if Peter Sellers had enough, certainly had enough clout and power in the room, probably more than Richard Norita at the time, he could have said, actually, I'm not going to, we don't even know what he said, but I do think that if he had said, actually, I'm not going to play this role or play this role this way, I can still be from China, but I'm not of Chinese descent, and I'm not putting in these teeth and doing this makeup on my eye. If he had said that, I wonder what would have happened. I do think that there could have been an opportunity for the actors to advocate a little bit more on, you know, and I don't know that he didn't, but I'm guessing that he didn't win that conversation if he did.
I think your point is perfect. I think, like, we don't know the situation. Granted, if that movie got made today, we would know the ins and outs of that casting, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and this movie probably wouldn't even have it happen. Yeah.
Mm-mm, it would not have.
But it's just, it's just like, I'm not saying like it's wrong, like we have to put all fault on Peter Sellers, but it's like, oh, you know, I think, and I just don't think people had that opportunity to stand up or advocate, or they didn't think they could advocate. And I think now that people of color and queer people and disabled community and everyone who have before not been included in the dominant culture, now that we have this voice, I think it's great we have this voice, we have this power, but like, oh, now how do we wield this power? You know, how do we harness it? How do we like make it, you know, not make us more divisive? You know, I could talk about this like all day. I love me a TED Talk moment, but I just, you know, I don't know if I see equity happening, but you know, I'm like, oh, well, we could get as close to it as possible. That's kind of like...
Well, I mean, true equity will really come when these larger companies and corporations aren't able to exploit their workers. And part of the thing, thinking back to maybe the way that things were back in the 1970s when they made the film, you know, we don't know how it was. Certainly the film industry is different today than it was then. Back then, studios had a lot more power than they have now, even though they still continue to hold a lot of the power. You know, people being able to advocate for different groups and minorities and things is much more prevalent now, for sure, especially when we're able to bring things to the public and then the public can vote. And like, you know, you can hold a network accountable and then somebody's doing an apology video the next day. That happens a lot these days, probably not so much back then. And that's because the actors and, you know, the individuals were probably kept a lot more separate. Things were, of course, they had a union by then. But I mean, the actors probably had a lot less power. So I don't mean to sort of contradict myself. I do think that if Peter Sellers had protested, it probably could have resulted in something good. And maybe there is notes of him saying, I don't want to do this. He obviously ended up doing it, nevertheless. But certainly the studios... where as long as the studios are able to keep people underpaid and fighting over scraps, then you're right. Then there won't be equity of race or gender or ability or any of those things, because those are the ways that they keep people separated, right?
Oh, God. Oof. There's a lot. There's a lot happening these days in these streets. But I do want to say before, like... I just want to mention that interesting towards the end when I forgot Eileen's character's name, but when she's like pointing out that Sam did drag and that he was like,
love it.
That was interesting, right? I was just like, oh, this was a turn. And then Sam's just like, no, it's research. You know, he was.
It was just
down.
Research. She was like, for six months or something like that. For six, every day for 6 months, it was research. And he was like,
Polaroid pictures of Sam in drag.
I was in disguise. Lots of dames go in those joints. I never kissed nobody. And I never did nothing to a man that I wouldn't do to a woman.
It was so weird. And the writing was on the wall that Sam was going to be gay because his character was from San Francisco, which is stereotypical. And then, you know, he was so... he was very misogynist to the women in the show. Like, his character was very misogynist.
Yes. Even the most.
He was the most misogynist.
The last time that I trusted a dame was in Paris in 1940. She said she was going out to get a bottle of wine. 2 hours later, the Germans marched into France.
So, you know, hello, gays, come on. And so, like, that's closeted. I'm not saying that gays are all misogynists, but you know, that was like sort of how they were telling that story, which is also problematic, right? To sort of, not that closeted people aren't a thing for sure, but like, you know, insinuating that, you know, people who treat women like that are closeted. It was just problematic all around with that character.
No, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
It was just like he was so overcompensating for his masculinity.
Overcompensating.
I was like, okay, we know this story. It's like, we know this story. We know what you're getting down with. And he's like, and then she kept on bringing up like more and more details. She's like, what was with all those magazines?
Sam, why do you keep all those naked muscle men magazines in your office?
Suspects. Always looking for suspects.
Yeah, what was with all the magazines? And what was with all the, yeah. And he was, I love he went coming to her, he's like, bitch.
I wrote that down. I said, how Sam Diamond, her name is Tess Skeffington. Tess Skeffington. Which is giving very Nightmare Before Christmas. I love it. it's like how she, he treats her. It's just like how a gay queen would treat their friend who is pretty but doesn't have self-confidence.
Mm-hmm. You
pretty
bitch.
Much that's a dynamic it gives. That's a dynamic it would give. Do you think Murder by Death would be a classic like Clue if it wasn't so racist?
perhaps because it is in the same sort of self-aware absurdist vein as Clue. It's a little more crude and paint by numbers than Clue. I think Clue is a lot more clever and isn't quite so like, you know, blatant with all of its things. And I think what Murder by Death did is rely really on the archetypes and stereotypes to run the whole movie. We're just going to be a whole bunch of racial stereotypes, sexual stereotypes, all these like tropes and things without really getting, there wasn't really much nuance for the characters, and we weren't able to see a lot of people's humanity. Everybody was a walking list of stereotypes, you know?
Yeah. I think, and also I was just thinking about this. Now I'm like, I feel like Murder by Death was first and then Clue. Like Murder by Death was like the first.
Oh yeah, Murder by Death was first. Clue was like 1981 or two.
Yeah. But it's like, it was like the first, it was like the beta. And then Clue was like all the new.
And Clue,
it felt like, yeah.
Yeah.
I do feel like if there was like two camps, like either you're a Clue queen or you're a Murder by Death queen. I feel like there's a very distinct kind of personality and like kind of where you hang your hat in these two movies. Because also the Murder by Death absurdity of them opening the doors into different, you know, rooms was like, you know, like kind of knocking and like all the confusion. It's like, and then, but also Clue took that and made Secret Passages and made it a little bit more
exactly.
Like, makes sense.
Yeah. It made sense a whole lot more. Sense. Yeah.
Now I want to watch Clue. Now I want to watch Clue.
You have to watch Clue. You have watch it again. Watch it again. I mean, I watch it so much. I think it's like
oh, flames on the side of my face.
Breathing. Yeah. Classic.
Love it. R.I.P. That's a good double feature. I'm sure people have done Murder by Death Clue double features plenty of times, because how can you not? But so the box office for this, according to Box Office Mojo, I don't know the budget. There's no record. I tried to research the budget. Couldn't find it. All time box office was $38,200, which I guess is good. I don't know for 1976.
No way. It's not good. It's still not good. $38,200 is what they made. Wow.
Yeah, that doesn't make. They also filmed it all on the Burbank lot, I think. All of this was on a soundstage.
Yeah.
It has a Rotten Tomato meter score of 67% for the critics, but the audience score is 82%, which makes perfect sense. Yeah. For awards, Truman Capote actually got nominated for a Golden Globe for this.
Who? I'm sorry, you cut out. Who got nominated?
Truman Capote got nominated for a Golden Globe.
I'm actually not shocked, because Truman, I mean, I wasn't used to seeing Truman as an actor, you know?
No, neither did I. Yeah.
And so I'm not surprised.
And to see him in a role like this, it's like, of course he's going to get a Golden Globe nomination. Neil Simon got nominated for a WGA award for Best Comedy. And also, I loved the costuming on this, so I looked up the costume designer, and it was Anne Roth, who was nominated for Best Costume Design 5 times, and won for The English Patient and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom in 2021. She appears as the woman at the bus stop in the Barbie movie, where Margot is at the... I don't know if you've seen Barbie.
Margot Robbie, yeah.
That's her! That's Anne Roth!
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's Anne Roth.
Isn't that wild? What is that little clue when they leave a little clue in the movie?
Easter egg.
Easter egg, yeah. Like what Easter an Easter egg, egg? Is, yeah. of, is that? I think the costume was lovely.
Anne Roth, who did the costume, and like she's good friends with Greta Gerwig. I just went down this rabbit hole because I was all, because I really loved how Maggie Smith looked. Like she looked gorgeous.
It was giving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though Eileen Brennan she was still serving floozy, but she looked impeccable, I think.
I love the look. She gave a look. But so I was like, who is the costume designer? Saw Anne Roth. And then I just kind of went down this rabbit hole of like, oh, wow. And then like, she also did, costuming for the HBO miniseries Angels in America and also Mildred Pierce. So love that. Also the screaming doorbell is Fay Wray's scream from King Kong in 1933.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that a fun fact?
That is actually a nice, really great fun fact. I mean, so that's something, that's an Easter egg for us, for the horror fans, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, which is brilliant.
Because she was a scream queen. Fay Wray was a scream queen.
And so they're like, let's have that
Orson
as the
Welles
doorbell.
And she's credited in the movie.
As doorbell?
As the screaming doorbell. Yes!
Wow. Orson Welles did what? Is what?
Orson Welles was considered for the role of Inspector Wang. Imagine that. And while Sir Alec Guinness was filming this, he got the script for A New Hope.
Of course he did.
A New Hope for Star Wars.
It came out 2 years later.
And he was reading it in his dressing room during this time. And it's so funny, in the beginning you mentioned that you love these old dark house movies. I didn't know that old dark house was an actual kind of like a genre. Like, I didn't it makes sense, but I just always saw it as mystery comedy genre, but I like how it's called old dark house. Also, there is an edit of this, of unreleased footage of Sherlock Holmes and Watson showing up at the very end. Also, Katharine Hepburn was meant to play Dame Abigail Christian based on Agatha Christie, but then dropped out after Myrna Loy dropped out of the movie. And then they hired Estelle Winwood to take the role of Elsa Lancaster. So that's fun. But yeah, I'm glad that you picked this. Like, I think you gave me kind of this list of movies, and I was all, I always want to watch something that I'm not familiar with. And I'm so happy that you... Now I want to talk about this to all my friends and be all, you need to watch it, even though it's racist. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
I'm glad. I've always enjoyed it. It holds a special place in my heart. And I think each year there's an opportunity every so often there's an opportunity to go back and see just how problematic it really is. And maybe there'll be some more things that, we didn't even talk about the sort of ableism happening in the film, which, with
everyone
pretending to be blind and then actually having two people with disabilities that we know of, the blind butler and then Nancy Walker playing Yetta the maid who's deaf and mute in the story.
What's that? I can't hear you. A little shy, are you?
Bizarre.
I put something down and what is with like all of this disabled kind of cosplay weirdness? Like it just was like, oh, what is going on here? Why do they, I guess it makes sense. Like they're all, how could we make it to where this is super silly? And I think they just kept on layering it on. And I was just like, oh, I think that's the only way you have to go, because if you don't lean into it totally, then you are really, really like, because if it wasn't as absurd, I think I'd have a different reaction.
This is definitely one of those that's greater than the sum of its parts, for sure. I think that there are a lot of problematic things. And I guess I'm sure that you ask the question all the time, can movies be sort of redeemed? And there's no way that this movie could have been remade in this way, or made in this way during this like current times. But for very good reason, I probably would not have supported it. But back in the context of what was going on in the day and times that it was, I can't make excuses for it. It was always problematic, but it did provide some really good entertainment in a genre. Like murder, mystery, and horror are not genres that generally bring home big box offices anyway. And they're not necessarily like critically acclaimed. They're never critically acclaimed. Rarely are they critically acclaimed, I should say. More so often now, for sure.
Yeah.
But this movie holds a special place, and I hadn't seen it in a while, but I remember it from my childhood. So it was great being able to watch it and have all the memories come back to life. I do think the performances performances of the actors, for the most part, were good and noteworthy and worthy of the legacy that many of these people would later on grow to have. The Maggie Smiths, the Peter Falks, you know, you
James
know,
Cromwell,
all these people are like,
they're icons.
They're icons now. And this was something along the, a stepping stone for them at some, in some way, shape or form. It is interesting that Neil, this is a bit of a departure for Neil Simon, I think. You know, this is definitely not the Brighton Beach Memoirs kind of thing. I do adore the film, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity to watch it with you.
Of course. I just think it's just so, I love Mia Murderman. I like the first time I saw Clue, I was just like, this movie is it, like, this is what I need. Like, I still love Glass Onion. I think Glass Onion is kind of like the modern day, you know, I loved, what was the recent one?
Oh, I can tell you real quick.
The one with Janelle.
Yeah, Janelle Monáe.
Knives Out, Glass Onion.
Knives Out.
It's called Knives Out. Knives Out, colon, Glass Onion. But I love how it's just like, how Rian Johnson is just kind of creating this genre, but putting a modern spin on it and like, you know, giving us like, just a whodunit and just having fun with it and creating these outlandish characters. And hopefully, Peppermint, you need to do one. This is a call to action.
I would love to be in a murder mystery. Hopefully. I would love, you know, what's that? What's that mystery? Oh God, I'm so sorry. There's a murder. There's another one. It's not quite a murder mystery, but it's still a mystery. Where she's going to get married.
Is that a series?
It's a movie where she's going to get married into the family. It came out like a year before the pandemic or 2 years before the pandemic. What's it called?
Who was in it?
Oh, this blonde girl.
Ready or Not. Ready or not.
Andy McDowell is yes. in it. Yeah. Yeah. I have to remember, it's a Fuji song.
Yes. I love that movie.
It has the same elements.
It's
not whodunit, but it has the same elements.
Yeah. There's also another one called Your Next. There's like kind of these, I love a last girl movie, like, you know, final girl movie, final girl. You know, where it's just like, yeah. Peppermint, do you have any, I mean, I know we're out in these striking streets, but where could people follow you? Are you working on anything you can talk about, you know, in terms of like music or anything? What are you doing to keep yourself busy these days?
I am participating in the strike enthusiastically. I'm hopeful that the parties that are involved will come to an agreement that everybody's happy with so that we can get on with the business of continuing to create art for film and television. In the meantime, in addition to just living my life and enjoying the summer, I am about to release part two of my film, which is an independent film that I created. It's called A Girl Like Me. There's part one, and part two is about to come out on Out TV. And it's a film short that is basically the film version of my trilogy of albums. And the third album in the trilogy will also be coming out at the same time. It's called Letters to My Lovers, Validation. And so those are both dropping at the end of the year. And they're follow-ups to the first two installments of the trilogy. It's a series of music and songs that I wrote and co-wrote about a relationship that I was in, the beginning, middle, and end of a relationship. Oh. That's why it's a trilogy. And it's really my foray into R&B music, like just very, it's not kitschy. It's not like, look at my glitter, look at my lashes, aren't I fabulous? It's none of that. It's just like, I'm a trans woman and these are my experiences in love. And so I wrote those songs and presented them. And the third album comes out and the film comes out to go along with it this fall.
Are you giving us like a Mary J. moment? Are you giving us like Adele? Are you giving, I'm loving old school R&B, like much 90s, early 2000s.
The music, the genre of the music is definitely very late 90s, early 2000s for sure. And the context and the songwriting, the fact that I'm writing about an ex is very, the very Taylor Swift of it all. but so that's what I'm serving. I love R&B. I love 90s R&B. I think everybody loves it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they do, but I certainly do. So I wanted to take a stab at it, and I hope people enjoy it.
I am all about the 90s R&B. I am, like, about the Troupe. I am about the Ralph Tresvants. I am about, I'm not going to say I'll Be Sure, but John, give me a John B. moment. Give me Jade. Give me SWV. Even like Donnell Jones featuring Lisa Left Eye Lopez. You know what's up? I'm that. I love it. Wait, are you? Did you go to the Renaissance tour or Eras tour? Are you doing?
I haven't seen any concerts
or anything?
In the past 2 years.
Are you not going to go to Renaissance or anything? Are you a concert girl? Or do you like?
I do like going to concerts. Yeah, yeah. But I don't have any plans to go to Renaissance because I'm working on something that means that I can't go to a lot of things.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Well, I'm going to Renaissance. I just like to tell everyone because I'm going to the hometown show in Houston, and I'm really excited because I'm originally from Texas.
Epic. So. And I'm living vicariously through you and all my friends who get to go see it.
Yeah. What, okay, so where can people follow you? Are you on are you still on X or whatever? Are you on Instagram? Are you a website? Plug away.
Peppermint247 on all socials.
Cool. Well, Peppermint, thank you so much. I love talking to you. I'm so glad you brought this movie into my life because now I'm just like, I'm just really interested. Now I'm going to, as soon as we sign off, I'm going to watch Clue now. Or it's just going to be playing in the background.
Yeah.
As I do things.
Boom.
Come on. Thank you so much, Peppermint.
My pleasure.
Problematic Fave podcast is presented by Diaspora and is created, hosted, and produced by Dino Ray Ramos. The series is also produced by Sanjay Sharma of Marginal Media Works and edited by Brian Aguilar. Special thanks to Cam. Subscribe to Problematic Fave on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate us. Diaspora is a media platform that amplifies intentionally exploited communities through its work. Follow Diaspora at Real Diaspora on Instagram and Twitter, or visit thediasporatimes.com. Follow Marginal at MRGNL Media on Instagram. You can send us all your problematic faves on social or email us at thisisdiaspora@gmail.com.